Then my sister got cancer, skin cancer, melanoma. It was a very dangerous kind. Over the last 3 months of her life using cannabis, she was able to go out to dinners, have movie nights with family, have conversations. So that it was really invaluable to me and to see that for my family. The doctors have done everything they can and still there's nothing for the person. It's kind of like the civic duty is pointed out to me is that if you could see a way to help someone who's suffering, then you have to do something about it.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Cannabis Law in Canada. I'm your host, Russell Bennett, a cannabis lawyer, author, podcaster, and re-emerging filmmaker in Toronto. Today I talk with Owen Smith, who is a cannabis industry subject matter expert. He spent 20 years working with patients, advocates, dispensaries, nonprofits, producers, processors, and even one of the world's largest cannabis corporations. Owen won a Supreme Court of Canada decision in 2015 called R.V. Smith, which is one of the most successful cannabis cases in Canadian history. Essentially, he legalized the process of cannabis extraction to make extracts, edibles, and oils for medical cannabis patients before legalization in 2018. I'll put a link to the case in the show notes. Owen is also a storyteller, multimedia artist, videographer, writer, juggler, and musician. Now, during the first part of our interview, at about the 18-minute mark, something weird happened when we were recording. Owen's audio started getting garbled, and I thought, as we were recording, that we'll probably be able to fix it in post. But after another 20 minutes of it, I just had to end the interview. It was terrible, and we had to start again on a different platform. Thanks go out to Jeremy Benning and to Byron Wong, who was able to correct some of the audio problem, which allowed us to use the last part of Owen's police bus story. And then we continue on from there. Anyway, I hope you enjoy. Owen Smith, welcome to the podcast.
Russell, it is a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
The pleasure is all mine, sir. You know, I have to begin by saying I've known of you since... Well, obviously, 2015, since the Supreme Court decision, your decision that changed the world, basically. But every now and then, your name will pop up either in the media or on my LinkedIn feed. And I have to say, your LinkedIn feed is so interesting. The first time I saw Owen Smith and then I saw your post, I was like, is this the same guy? And I was flummoxed because it was... I remember the first thing I saw of yours on LinkedIn was posts of your images of an imagined cannabis lounge. And I remember looking at the post going, oh, this is kind of cool. And then diving into all the different photos or images that you created of all these different kinds of cannabis lounges, completely different from one another. Is that you?
This is a creation that emerges from the depths of my soul. It's the deepest need of my being to have somewhere to collectively consume cannabis with the best people in the world. Yeah.
Nice. And are we talking about like you take an image from your mind and you create it on a computer? Like, could you tell me the how?
I use Midjourney mostly. Midjourney is an image generating software that takes text prompts, just word combinations that you can tie together to create these, really anything. One example which people could take a look at these days is, just came out, is the new Marvel series, Secret Invasion. And see, this Marvel has an intro sequence of animation that has used the image generation technology to create this. It is a rapidly developing set of tools, And even just today, I am breaking into new capacities for this tool to, I'm so excited about, is the infinite zoom capacity that just was released.
Ooh, so infinite zoom. I know what that means.
So my imagination says things like, what is the center of the scene? Take a big scene, any big scene. Maybe it's a consumption lounge or an event, a festival event. And at the center, maybe you've got like a bud in a bong or someone smoking a bong. And then you can expand from there. You can get the crowd in. You can get the stage in. You can get the event venue in, the surrounding areas in. And you keep zooming out and including all of this world that you generate with these images. And of course, with cannabis at the center, it's an amazing tool that has given me the ability to put my thoughts, my imagination into a form that people can connect with, which is wonderful that you connected with it. And I just say this, there's a lot to this, not just Midjourney, but the stable diffusion technology, which is all free. It's all open source. You just need a good graphics card to run it. And so Nice. It's an exciting time for independent artists like myself who have a lot of ideas for how the world could be made more beautiful or more interesting. And now we can get those ideas into forms that people can act on. I'm just working on an architectural project for a cannabis company that is doing everything from consumption lounges to production and dispensary and all of this stuff. So I'm extraordinarily excited to be able to contribute to that sort of thing, allow them to look at their vision before having to build it, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And you mentioned in part of your explanation, the cannabis at the center. How did cannabis get to the center for you?
Cannabis as a, well, for me, my whole life, I see cannabis as an untapped natural resource. You know, we could build a lot around it. When I first came to cannabis, it was hemp that excited me. Jack Herer and the tales of four times the pulp production from an acre of hemp, which you get from an acre of trees. Mm-hmm. And the tragedy of old growth logging. That's been a major source of inspiration for many of the cannabis activists that I know is really the material transformation of our world using natural resources. I have one other project that's very popular called the Cannabis Theme Park. And the Cannabis Theme Park, I would imagine, you know, you've got a lot of fabricated objects, rides, things you should look at, statues. It's an opportunity for hemp there. We, in Canada, we have now hemp plastic and hemp building material facilities that are being accessed now for the first time. We previously only had food processing, food oil processing facilities. And so the hemp part of this, of our work with cannabis, is a slow moving but profoundly impactful. And I feel like that really puts it at the center of what would be a sustainable future for humanity, to start transitioning some of our plastics production to these natural materials.
I'm totally with you. And I read Herer's book as well. So walk me through the first moment, aha moment you had where cannabis became, oh, geez, this is amazing hemp plant. When was that? Were you a kid? You know, was it last year? Like, where were you? What happened?
I was lucky because I had Ted Smith to introduce me. I was at the college locally in Victoria, BC on Vancouver Island where I live. and studying sociology. And Ted was giving lectures outside the hall that I was studying in to just every Wednesday, a circle of people would meet there and they would smoke joints. And he would then talk about the news, about cannabis, about hemp, about the politics, about the science. And I found it was dramatic. And inside the building, I was hearing about how bad things were going in the world, and all the challenges and the lack of solutions. Outside the building, there was a man just calling it out from a megaphone. Here is solutions to many of these things that are not being discussed in academic places. And so I got Ted Smith. He brought me into the club, the Hempology 101 Club. I became the president of that club. I then hosted a cannabis convention at the college, bringing in speakers such as Chris Bennett, the cannabis historian, and sponsors like early nutrients companies that were helping people grow cannabis, this sort of thing. Would have been back in 2003 or something now. And I started postering for them for their events. Ted would put on a lot of cannabis events in town, like anything he could think of. It was game shows, costume contests. He did a comedian act, a one-man comedian act in front of the courthouse. We used to hang banners on the side of the stairways to the courthouse and hotbox the area underneath the stairways to the courthouse. It would be full of people and it would be thick with smoke. And there's, you know, it's just that street level, community focused, awareness raising campaign, sort of street theater, that sort of thing. That's how I got into it, thanks to Ted.
That sounds like a lot of fun, a great introduction to the scene. And I'm actually going to be talking with Ted actually next week after your podcast. I met Ted on my tour through Victoria once or twice when I was doing a fringe show called The Reefer Man. And Ted was very, very supportive of me and the show, and he would take me on a tour. I think we went to the legislature to do a protest, and we did some kind of circle in the woods. So it was it was a good time. That was 2004, long time ago. Almost 20 years ago. It's crazy.
He told me about that, you know, that you did a one man cannabis show, and that is incredible. I think that's amazing.
Yeah, thanks.
That is so creative. And I hadn't seen it, so I got it.
Oh, geez. All right. Well, you know, I've always been thinking of doing a remount, but you know, it's just time. I don't know what to focus on. Right. I'm moved into law and a fatherhood, and so it's difficult to have my own time to do stuff like this. The podcast is really now my source of creativity. But I'd love to come back to Reefer Man. That was a beautiful time. It was a way to engage with people, just like you're talking about Ted's ability with street theater to engage people in a more formal. I mean, fringe theater is not that formal, but it, you know, with $10 as it being the ticket price, it's accessible to more people. And I didn't want to do something that was banging people over the head in a polemic. I wanted to do something that was funny and engaging, and yet, you know, I'd put stuff in there like a seance with Mackenzie King and Emily Murphy to talk about the history, stuff like that. But but I didn't at the time. Obviously, you hadn't gone to the Supreme Court yet, and you hadn't been arrested yet, and so I couldn't put you in the show. Otherwise, I would have put you in the show. Maybe for a sequel, I will. So I want to flash forward from the early 2000s. Then sometime in 2009, it seems like you incurred the wrath of a neighbor of some kind in the in the condo building. You were baking. Could you walk me through the initial, like, what, how did, okay, how'd you go from postering and hotboxing the courthouse or legislature steps, rather, to baking in a condo and somebody smelling the baking? You know, how did that all happen?
Well, yeah, I'd learned about cannabis and the medical stuff because Ted has the dispensary in Victoria had at the time. And so I had a sense for it. And I'd asked to be the baker. I said, you know, I'd like to help. And they had a baker. So I moved out of the town and I went for a few years gardening, landscaping, backpacking around. And then my sister got cancer, skin cancer, melanoma. From a sunburn out east, doing a student exchange program. And it was a very dangerous kind. So they had to do surgery to remove the mole on her head and then lymph nodes all down her neck. And so she had extreme like pain from the surgery that she needed to recover from. But my mom worked at a doctor's office, and so we had a pretty close relationship with the medical establishment, and they went and did everything they could to help her, and chemotherapy and all the drug regimens, as well as multiple surgeries, having to go back and again for more surgery, to the point where they couldn't do anything. I had talked about cannabis with my family. While it would be helpful for her chemotherapy, it was important for the doctors to have her under strict controls. So they did not want her to have cannabis because it might interfere with the regimens they were giving her. And it was only until there was nothing left that they could do. They really had to give up that my family took her to the VCBC and to Ted's Club to get some cannabis because she wasn't sleeping. She wasn't eating, and those things had to be, like, you know, made it impossible for her to do anything, converse, you know, the sort of thing. It was a very rough state. Her cannabis consumption instantly gave her appetite, which one thing leads to another. She had a good sleep and the next day was feeling much better. And over the last 3 months of her life using cannabis, she was able to go out to dinners, have movie nights with family, have conversations. So that it was really invaluable to me and to see that for my family, how much suffering actually continues on in the world through diseases like this, where the doctors have done everything they can and still there's nothing for the person. And only left to suffer. Well, you know, it's kind of like, the civic duty is what is pointed out to me, is that if you could see a way to help someone who's suffering, then you have to do something about it. Otherwise, it's just going to eat at you forever. I don't know, you know. So I had to go from this situation to see if Ted needed any more help. And it just turned out after a little while longer that his baker did. And I took over the role in 2007. It was only about a year and a half or something before I got arrested. And in that time, I was taught how to make all the products from Gail, Ted's girlfriend at the time. She had developed a product line to include massage oils and salves and include other herbs that could complement cannabis for specific purposes, like comfrey, for instance, which is known to help with bones. For people who have bone conditions, a comfrey massage oil seemed to work better. Other things like St. John's wort, arnica, and these sort of things. But some of them come with their own warnings, but that was always included. And members really found that the expansion of the product line was really helpful for them. And so I was a DJ on the weekends, and I'd play a sort of heavy bass music called dubstep music. And I loved it. And I would practice my DJ sets in the evenings, and then I would listen to them while I was baking in the day. listen to them, and then, oh, and I tweak this. In the evening, I go back to it. And then on the weekends, I play to crowds of dancing people. So I was really into it. And maybe it was just a little too loud that day, because there was a call from a neighbor that the noise complaint combined with a smell complaint, which was due to the fact that it was a December morning and the air filtration unit had become clogged from working too hard, and there was no incense, and so the smell seeped out into the hallway and into the other people's apartments. And the building manager called the cops. The cops came to the door and, you know, did their rap, their tap and rap. And two doors down were members of the VCBC who knew that the bakery was there. And once they heard that, they called Ted at the club and told him, hey, look, there's some police coming to your bakery. And so he knew right away, and he and a couple of members of the staff came over to this building, outside the building, and began to talk with the police at that time, while I was inside the building talking with the two officers who had come in. The consequent officers that took me away. It was a profound experience, really. You don't get opportunities like that very often, where you get to stand at this junction point where there are police and you know they're wrong and you know you're right. And you get to tell them. This is what I did. I just told them the consequences of their actions. I know, like, people oftentimes can get really angry and emotional in these moments. But for me, I had prepared my, like, talking points for when the police would come. I had sat out for many lunch breaks, smoking a big joint, eating a sandwich, and thinking about the moment that the police would come through the door. What would I want to say? What would be the best thing for me to say? So I was thinking, well, the best thing would be to tell them just directly the truth. As much truth as you can get in their ears, the more impact that it would have. And so I would just tell them the consequences of their actions. The fact that they would come to take the medicine away from people would mean that these people will be seizing tonight. They will be writhing in pain. They will, you know, not be able to sleep. They won't be able to eat, some of them. And some of them are in extreme situations of cancer or multiple sclerosis. And just keep going on, just telling them the reality and the facts. I found that was impactful in the moment. They sort of took a step back as they knew that I was calm in delivering this, but I was not going to sort of let them go get away with it without hearing at least that much, you know, the real consequences. I can't blame them for having a job. You know, there's lots of people who have jobs that don't have to do this sort of thing. So I want them to think about it at least when they go to sleep tonight.
So this is the point in the interview where we had to discard the first part and realized how garbled it was becoming due to a streaming connection issue. This is the next section where we picked up the interview and had the problem solved.
Cannabis is on its way back to humanity.
I'm a robot. Hello, I'm a robot.
Could you introduce yourself? Who are you with that voice? Let me say, who are you?
Hello, I am Owen Smith.
That's an interesting robot. I love robots. One of my favorite is Wall-E. Have you seen Wall-E?
Yeah. Great movie.
Great robot.
I was recently working on a project for sustainability in cannabis where we would build a company that would take plastic back from the retailers and bring it to the producers to save the landfill.
Ooh.
So the Wall-E opening sequence where he's a little garbage monster who goes around collecting and stacking garbage, a garbage robot, I should say, was an inspiration to us. And I made a comic book to help illustrate what we're trying to do for the cannabis supply chain, where we follow Polly the package from excavation in the jungle to all of the shipping that needs to happen to get the materials to the factory to make the plastic, and then the further shipping of the plastic to the warehouse where it's got to sit and then be shipped again to the retailer, and then it's got taken home. All of this extravagant transportation, all really just to end up with Wall-E.
The cannabis theme park. Okay, what is it?
Building on to the idea of a cannabis consumption lounge. So I did first indoor consumption lounges, different kinds, extravagant and opulent ones, or natural ones, ones that would be very comfortable and warm feeling, you know, giving some very distinct style. And then what I imagined was that you could have a number of consumption rooms or lounges in on one property, and that they could be designed differently for different kinds of cannabis experiences. Whether you felt more like this or that, cannabis is for everybody, and so we can design many experiences to cater to the different cannabis people.
It's a good idea.
You come into this park and you select your consumption area. Of course, you can go to multiple ones if you want, experience them all. But from there, you have access to the center of the park, which is essentially, you know, a natural place that people can walk around and appreciate with their elevated state, the plants and the animals there, as well as the art and the themed installations. It's very fun to think about all of the things that you might want to have at your cannabis park. Some of the ideas which I'm working with are like cannabis mini golf or cannabis petting zoo.
Nice.
Where you've got all the kittens and people just want to, they're high, they just want to pet kittens and baby goats and mini donkeys and things like this.
Nice.
Absolutely lovely. There's the Vaporize Theater. So at Vaporize Theater, you go inside and there is vapor released into the room over top of the audience. And then projectors put imagery into the vapor so that the experience of sitting in one of these things, you could look up and you could see, you know, butterflies projected into the mist, and you could sip the mist, which would be cannabinoid rich, and inhale a cannabinoid rich butterfly made out of light. So these sort of things are just so much fun to think about. And of course, once you have a vaporized theater, you can think about what products the vaporized theater would accentuate, such as a home theater projector, which has a vaporized unit in it that will release vapor into the room while you watch movies at home.
Mm.
Or you can do it simply more analog and have a theater production, where you've got people performing an act, such as the Reefer Madness musical or Reefer Man, one-man show on the stage.
Yes.
Vapor is introduced as part of the production at certain times. It could create mist, that could be thematic to the story, and it could be incorporated creatively by artists such as yourself.
Nice.
Once that technology is available. So me and Ted have too much fun with this. Like, we're thinking bumper dab boats. So you get into the bumper boat on the lake and you've got a little sort of dome over you, but you've got a dab rig built into the boat with a hose out of it. So you can dab, cloud yourself up and charge about bumping into people on the lake. Which for certain cannabis consumers, that's just what they've been waiting for.
I can't wait to see it. That is that sounds like so much fun. And of course, the whole snack bar, maybe food court area, you know, you can introduce a whole array of new consumption ideas. I'd like you to talk a bit about those pakoras. Did you ever, you mentioned in the part of our interview where it got garbled about one of your arresting officers back in 2009 had, you tell me the story again, please. It's just too juicy or crusty or whatever, however you want to say it.
The officer, he had stopped out front of the VCBC and with his police van in the middle of traffic, you know, just guess cops can do that. And he called out to Ted in the middle of the road from sitting in this driver's seat of the car. And Ted comes running out, you know, there's police sitting outside your illegal dispensary. And he's like, oh, yeah, I just wanted to tell you, I just in India and my family celebrate a cannabis consumption festival each year, Holy Festival, where they consume cannabis as part of their spiritual. And they've been doing it forever. And my grandmother has a recipe for pakoras, for cannabis infused pakoras that they were enjoying while I was there recently. So this for me, this anecdote shows me like how much we've lost, how much is so naturally human and relates to cannabis, but has been forcibly, you know, very expensively removed from our society for not a good reason. We could have recipes and food and festivals dedicated to help people with their cannabis consumption in a community sense. I mean, we've been, it is such that it's told that it's been going on for as long as anyone can remember. And yet in the 20th century, it was seen fit to try to stop that relationship from continuing. And really, we only stand to benefit from continuing that relationship. I think everything we've seen in the 20th century goes to, you know, and in the 21st century, we need cannabis now more than ever for both medicinal and just generally for human health. You know, there's this very sick people who we serve at the Victoria Cannabis Buyers Club, the most sick people who are still in need of those high strength THC products. But really, everybody has an endocannabinoid system that could be easily served with a little bit of cannabis introduced into normal life.
And that's okay, hold on a second. I have to ask you a couple of questions about this. So, the first is the medicinal part of cannabis seems to have been lost in this translation of legalization, where the proponents of legalization had this groundswell movement from Mr. Parker, 2000, all the way up to your case, 2015, to Mr. Allard and his group in 2016, to say, look, we need this for medicine. And Health Canada is not responding to us in a way that we need access, the proper access. For your case, dried marijuana, as it was called in your case, was not insufficient for people who need it in different ways. Great. But now we have legalization and everybody's saying, well, you can get it in every store in Toronto. We've got 10 billion stores on every corner. What's the deal? Why can't you just go into a store and buy whatever you need? What's the problem now? So let me just ask you about that. We have legalization. People are making cannabis. It's in stores. What's the problem?
The problem is that it's arbitrarily restricted to a 10 milligram per product per package. And
what's the problem with that?
The person who needs 100 milligrams is being arbitrarily forced to consume a lot of things which they don't necessarily need. It's arbitrary. So somebody who would need a 1,000 milligram dose, for instance. I even had a guy here who took 2,500 milligrams for his methadone withdrawals, which is astronomical, right? But to think about how many gummies that you'd need to eat for that, or the oil that you'd have to drink, the carrier oil, that in itself can lead to other health issues, just trying to get the cannabinoids into you legally. And that is arbitrary. There really is nothing, there's no good reason why the government has set that up to protect these people. It's not for these people, really. These are the people who need that high dose. It's still a necessity. So we would provide it in a raw format so that they could get it. And the price, if it's not the strength, but the price in the legal stores is somewhat like 100 times what it costs for us to produce for some of these things. It's just ridiculous, the amount that they'd have to eat and the amount they'd have to pay to eat those things is unreasonable. That's the basis of it. We are going to have a storefront medical that can provide these higher dose products for those who need it, and also for the medical shops to have the ability to talk about it. Currently, the legal shops can't discuss anything related to health or wellness with people who come in to get cannabis, which is contrary to the path that we've walked together here, which is very much talking to people about its qualities. People are left to find out for themselves, which they can do, but it's much easier for people, especially if they are medical patients, some of whom don't have access to the internet or have secure housing and things like this. They need help. So we want some sort of training program or some sort of pharmacy assistant inserted to these medical storefronts where people can get the higher dose at the reasonable price.
And what's your assessment of the current state of access for people who are applying for the medical documents? So if you go to a physician, the physician says, sure, you can grow your own, or you can have somebody grow, designated grower for you, up to like 1 to 3 grams per day is your amount. You know, how is that system working do you know about that system? And is that part of,
It seems like there's issues with doctors have with prescribing cannabis and the amounts that they prescribe. I know back a little while ago when this was starting out and we were arguing for edibles and all you could have was dried cannabis, doctors loved hearing that their patients were going to turn their cannabis into an edible or a topical because they just don't want them smoking, right? Just this most obvious thing. And they would say, I need 5 grams dried for my massage. I need 5 grams for this. And they'd end up with these huge licenses with 100 grams. And I had met one person with 150 gram license. And so you could grow 750 plants. And like, this was astronomical. I know there's doctors that are still doing higher licensing and fighting it somewhat when Health Canada pushes back. It's very confusing, I think, for doctors trying to understand cannabis when they haven't been given a thorough education in it, given that some of them were in medical school far before some of these cannabinoids were discovered and parts of the systems being uncovered really on the cutting edge of science. Some integration seems really necessary for doctors to be able to feel more comfortable prescribing cannabis, specifically amounts, because I think it's still very confusing for people what cannabinoids and what ratios and amounts and how it relates to the individual and their particular condition. I think there's a lot we're going to learn from studying cannabis now that it can be studied outside of the context of abuse.
There's hope.
Mm-hmm.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. So are you actively involved in this latest court case with the VCBC?
I'm on the board of directors. So I'm not named anywhere, but I've had to move 5 or 6 times in the last 3 years. And so there may be a letter being sent back to them. Who knows? But yeah, I'm involved as much as I'm helping with volunteering, mostly with the media end of things, like holding a phone, holding the camera, live streaming.
Right.
That sort of thing.
So your relationship with Ted Smith goes back a long time. I think in our first iteration of our interview, you were talking about the first time you ever met him was hearing him. Was it through a bullhorn? And what was it about that attracted you away from your studies inside? You said you distinguish it between, you know, learning about the world collapsing and falling apart inside the building, and then coming out and hearing the potential solutions outside. What was it that initially attracted you to hear, to consider Ted as something more than just some lunatic with a bullhorn?
Simple answer: marijuana. I guess as a young person, I had discovered marijuana. I came from England, and so there wasn't a lot of cannabis in England. Canada, it was way more, especially in Vancouver Island, way more available than we had predicted. And it sort of started integrating. My brother introduced me, and me and my brother, we went down to the Parliament buildings to go buy some weed. And he's like, yeah, there's this guy down there and has a circle and we can find weed there. So Ted, like before the college, Ted was doing these, he was running for mayor, and he was dressed up like a dinosaur in like one of these big dinosaur costumes and had the megaphone. And there was, I think it was pipelines or oil. At the time, there was a big oil thing going on, and he was speaking out against the clear cutting of the forests and the oil industry's barbarity and making a big scene out of it. But really, I was there for the weed. And got a dime bag, and it was better than the dime bags that I could get at City Hall. Back in the day, there used to be a few guys hanging out in front of City Hall. Me and my friends, we would go down there, you know, and one of us would get to go out and talk to the guy and then come back to the car, and we drive off quickly. And then we look at the bag, and it's like, oh, it's a 0.8 or whatever, and it's wet, and it's in one of those tiny little square bags, like whatever, stick it in the 4-hose bong and off we go. over time, what Ted's impact was with the VCBC, which was kind of dramatic, was that those people at City Hall disappeared. They stopped being there. They actually lost their business. Many of those people selling weed at City Hall were, you know, these shady dime bag dealers were providing to medical patients. Medical patients were basically forced to go do what the kids would do to get their medicine. And in the court case I sat in on with Ted, it was called the chaperone case. The judge was chaperone. And it was about this. What she said was that it was, you know, unbelievable. It was abhorrent that my AIDS patients have to go downtown and buy it. And now without a place like Ted's where they could have a warm, comfortable, somewhere that is accountable, will be there again tomorrow, that sort of thing, they had nothing else to do. And the police chief had been on the stand, and his testimony was that it's cleaned up City Hall. The there are less dealers downtown now because Ted has taken over that business and brought it inside. And we're happy with that. We were happier to have it like that. So you can see how it can benefit communities, and it's a good business to do.
Where did you grow up in England?
I grew up in Portsmouth on the south coast in Hampshire.
And how long were you there for?
Until I was about 12 years old. Yeah.
Right.
Just a kid.
Why did you move to Canada?
My father found a better job. They found there'd be more opportunity here. There's a recession going on in England at the time. There's 50 odd million people packed into that little island. And so there's lots of folks from there who end up immigrating out in search of more opportunity.
Did he find it? Did he find more opportunity?
He did. He did. And he started his own company at about the same age that I am right now. And he's now retired and has sold his security and electricity service.
Nice. Good for him. That's great. And is your mom, does she work, or is she still around?
Yeah, well, my mom used to work in a doctor's office.
Okay.
Which was why we were so close in with the doctors when my sister passed. I think we talked about that in the other segment.
Yes. She passed. I didn't know she passed.
Yeah, my sister had a melanoma skin cancer and passed within 1 year of getting it. Even with cannabis coming in at the last 3 months to give her quality of life and the ability to talk, sleep, eat, hang out with her family, she was still overcome by the disease. It's very dangerous and it kills a lot.
How did she get melanoma to begin with? Do you know?
She was doing a student exchange program with a kid from Quebec and got a bad sunburn. And that's all it takes.
Just one sunburn?
You just come from a really bad sunburn, yeah. So it's something
that
folks in Australia are very aware of. It's something that in some parts of the world where the sun can be very dangerous to people, especially fair-skinned people. It's
from England, England, south coast folks with fair skin, going to, and where was she, in Quebec?
Yeah, she was doing student exchange with a fellow. She was going to university for music at University of Victoria.
Oh.
She would sing at the local church on Sundays as part of a scholarship, you know, a proper angelic type.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah.
What was her name?
Carrie.
Carrie. It's a beautiful name. And she passed in 1 year. I can't believe it. That's unbelievably. Your parents must have been so devastated.
Absolutely. And knowing that kind of thing goes on, like how prevalent cancer is in society, these people don't often talk about their sadness and their, these situations go undiscussed. And yeah, it gave me the sense that there's this great undercurrent of sorrow and suffering in our society simply because there's no access to a suitable medicine that can either help or ease the suffering, at least for those who otherwise can't be treated.
Was it because you had already been involved with Ted Smith and VCBC prior to your sister getting melanoma that she had the access? Or was it, because most people, you're right, most people have cancer even today, still, even with legalization, don't see cannabis as a medicine, as a potential method or tool for relieving whatever ailments. How did you and your sister end up getting that benefit for the brief amount of time?
Well, it was only after my parents had tried all the other conventional way that they agreed to go down to the VCBC and sign her up and get cannabis. So,
can I ask about the discussion? Like, what was that discussion with your parents? I'm sure they didn't use cannabis.
That's right. Not familiar either. Coming from England, it's not something that we're very socialized towards. So mostly, my parents, even after I won the thing, they're still not that into it. They still got this, like, I don't know if it's safe because of a whole lifetime of listening to people tell them that it's not.
You know? Won a Supreme Court decision, and your folks are still weary. I love that.
Well, my pop's actually been coming and volunteering to help at the VCB.
Oh.
Do a little bit of handiwork, which has been very good.
That's nice.
You know, he's been nibbling on some gummies lately. So it helps with sleep. And really, cannabis is old people medicine. Really, you know, I imagine as I get old, I'll just be eating more and more of it.
And, so true. As I'm getting older, I can attest it definitely helps. I think I saw a meme go around LinkedIn last week that the war on drugs is really a war on the elderly.
Mm.
And just to dovetail on your point, I thought that was really an interesting perspective. You know, I mean, we're talking about a giant population, a lot of baby boomers going through the cancer, debilitating diseases, you know, degenerative life or energy, all the rest of it. And they need support, right? And as you're saying, there's still not access. There's still not proper access. 10 milligrams doesn't buy you enough. It's too expensive. So, okay, paint me the picture then, Owen Smith, in your beautiful fantasy of the ideal storefront dispensary, what place where somebody who's 75, who has now been diagnosed with some kind of cancer, is like, oh shit, what am I going to do? What's your vision for that person?
Well, in this dispensary, I would be able to, it'd be a different sort of look in that it does today. You'd have a lot more creative products and a lot more extract product. And these would sort of fill the gap. You would have oil that you could supply, or at least an edible form of cannabis at various strengths that you could supply to those who really need it. And that should be at no cost, just like we're used to medicine being provided to those in need. And then you would have your regular cannabis. You know, you could have as much of that as you want. Then you'd have your special cannabis. That's like the various forms of high quality cannabis that smell and taste like the most amazing things. And then you'd have all of the extract products that in my vision of it, we'd be encouraging people to consume cannabis in a more comprehensive sense. So eating topicals and inhalation for different purposes or for different people's functional day. And there would be a big pot of cannabis chai that people could come and they could have a sip of this and warm their bellies. And the approach would be more towards getting people to consume low amounts of cannabis daily, something in the range of 1-to-1 ratio or CBD dominant, as maintenance doses. My theory behind that is that cannabis hemp is a great food crop. It's always been a wonderful food crop for humans, has been a staple for many societies using the seed. However, in ancient times, you would have resin coated onto it. Through my studies of places like Morocco, where they did tests of old cannabis, really old cannabis that was growing there, they found the ratio to be around 1-to-1 for that. So I imagine that part of our evolutionary history involves eating low doses of 1-to-1 cannabis resin with our breakfasts. And we would have then felt good. We've just been felt fit. This is just how you feel, right? In a normal day, like when you eat food, typically after it, you feel good. Well, cannabis just adds a little bit to that. And I think that is a healthy way to have it. And once you have a little bit of cannabis in your system, if you decide to smoke a little bit or vape a little bit or have a bigger dose, it's not going to hit you like a ton of bricks, like it tends to do for people who have endocannabinoid systems, which have done nothing for years or very, very little. You know, maybe they're not even eating healthy food. They're not producing the EFAs that are you building blocks for your endocannabinoids. So, you know, dealing with this concept of endocannabinoid system deficiency would be the slow win for humanity, I think, returning us to a state of normalcy with cannabis being in our diet, even right at the start of the day, you know, just sort of like.
Okay, great. Walk, that sounds interesting to me and really, really great. But for those who don't understand what you're talking about, and there may be people who are like, okay, what 1-to-1 resin breakfast, what does that look like?
1-to-1.
What are you talking about?
Means a THC to CBD. So an equal amount of each. In our day, we've seen, and we're seeing it again with legalization, we see the people who grow cannabis for the purposes of creating an effect that you can feel. They're going for that, the THC, right? That's this buzz on that you get that part of it. And in prohibition times, these THC cultivars became 200-to-1 ratios, where you had 200 times THC to the one CBD. And that was the problem for some people. That's some of the strains like the Jack Herer. I don't know, like some people love that, but those are where people talk about unwanted experiences, rapid heart rate. Any of the stuff which is a concern with cannabis comes from the high THC, low or no CBD cultivars. And so this is a prohibition thing that, you know, it's happening again with legalization. You're seeing companies put out THC with 30-40%, which is like, really? Is that true? I don't know. Right. But even if it is true, why? Why?
Right.
Because really, if you had a little bit of extract, you got as strong as you like you really don't need to force the plant to juice so hard when you can simply reconstitute your puff with resins. So whether it's simple hash, which, you know, comes in at a 40-50% THC, or some of the more concentrated forms which are popular these days, like shatter, 60-70%, live resin, 70-80%, or into the distillates, which are up in the 90s, or even the isolates, which are in the 99%. So we have many ways which we can take the cannabinoid and refine them, and we've measured it out, we can weigh it, and it's out at 99%, you know exactly how many cannabinoids you're dealing with. A CBD distillate is really nice for that. A CBD isolate, I should say. And then, of course, you can then create creatively combinations like infused pre-rolls are one of the rising categories in the market. And these are places for creativity to emerge, where the product actually meets the consumer somewhere, where the consumer is like, oh, this product actually has a little something in it that is meant for me, instead of being what I see currently, which is a lack of creativity and a lot of the same products. And people are trying to say, oh, I'm creative because my flavor is mango, pineapple, strawberry, not mango, banana. Like, we've been there. We're dealing with something different now, dealing with a compound which has physiological effects that you can feel. And there's this balance act that we can play with ratios. And that's all very interesting to me, and I see it being, you know, the some of the benefits that we're going to have moving forward. You can count your cannabinoids and you can ratio them out.
Right. Okay. And this, so the, moving forward, this seems to be requiring a lot of research and education. And it seems like the next decade, or however long it takes to move the needle on what your dad currently knows as like, oh, gummy will help me sleep, to what you're talking about, which is a whole new product development strategy based on the division and multiplication of different cannabinoids and combination, isolate, distillate, all these things. So we're really, really moving into unknown territory, or maybe territory that has previously been known, especially India. I mean, imagine a cannabis festival every year where like the whole point is you go and you smoke weed or eat weed. Like you said, consumption festival. Is that what that officer was?
The Holi Festival.
Sorry?
Holi Festival, which is also known for its like colorful dyes. You can find on YouTube videos of people celebrating Holi Festival in India.
Amazing.
Guys like sitting out on the roof, all baked, out in the street with a big chai, and everybody gets a cup in, and then they go about celebrating in the street.
This is not some tailgate party. This sounds like it's also a community-oriented, perhaps. I don't know. What's the vision on children then involved in something like that? Like and what's your take on kids and cannabis?
Well, in these cultures around the world where cannabis has been cultivated for a long, long time, for a very, very long time, as long as they can remember, kids are involved in the harvesting process. You'd have kids go out to the field and grab a bushel and bring it in, sort of thing. Do I think there are health and safety concerns around kids grabbing bushels of cannabis? I don't think we need to use kids for our production here, but I can see why in traditional societies that family businesses might do stuff like that. And having done it for as long as they have, I'd imagine that they are doing good and have a way to do it that is safe for their children. Here in Canada, it seems though the child's brain, the developing brain, is all the way up to age 25 is sacred ground. Health Canada wants to claim that ground. But of course, individuals after a certain age, when they become adults, they can make decisions all for themselves. The idea is that the brain is still changing, and anything that you introduce to the brain during development could have impacts on how it develops. This seems pretty obvious to me, and we've got alcohol as well, which is shown in studies recently to have no positive effects for anybody. And of course, kids are consuming it ritualistically. I was one of those kids, and you get to that point when you're a teenager, and it can be dangerous. I had a friend who died of alcohol poisoning. He was, yeah, no, it was very sad, just after a night of drinking. And I'm like, you know, the devastation of alcohol is far and wide. And yet it's still our sort of the youth's path through to adulthood is littered with bottles of alcohol.
And you know, there's a study that just came out. I remember Normal posting it in the States about the first use by a child of alcohol and or tobacco versus cannabis, and the study examines the effects on children of the first use, whether your first use was alcohol and then tobacco, or and it was, I think that alcohol encouraged the second use of tobacco. It was kind of they came in tandem as things to try. But then the small percent, 6%, were found that were the group that tried cannabis first, and then what happened to them later on. And it was an unbelievable result that children who tried alcohol first had an increased risk of developing all kinds of problems later on versus the small group that tried cannabis first. So I just wanted to push that out there concerning what you were talking about. Are you aware of that study?
Reminds me of the Safer campaign. That was what, for me, that was what was the big win, was Mason Tavert in Colorado when they, I guess it was Washington at the same time. But all the arguments were like, that was like, I guess the big, they beat Sam out in terms of making those arguments. Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
Yeah, no, let's pick up on Sam for a second. That's a good place to pick up on. Sam, you were saying, and I think in our previous attempt to interview, was smart approaches to marijuana and how that group was opposed originally to any form of legalization based on harm. Is that what your recollection?
That's right. They were presenting all of the arguments of prohibition in the news debates. So when Safer, that we had their message was, it's a safer choice than alcohol. It's safer, and there's lots of evidence to say that people should have a safer choice. And that was the argument that won in Colorado, and really felt like it was the a potent place to meet society, knowing that we do have an alcohol problem. Somewhat hard to talk about because it's so widespread, and we are still promoting alcohol consumption at the same time as governments are coming out to say it's causing cancer and has no positive benefits that anyone can draw from. So having a safer option, having cannabis, you know, it starts as like somebody could smoke a joint. Sure, that's safer. Like nobody's died from smoking a joint, but then you can continue down that road and you can help people with low risk, people who don't take risks, have safer options too, right? They don't want to drink, but they don't know any better. And it seems to me as though humans do need these medicines, take their mind off things. You know, have a rough day, you could take the bottle or you could take the bong. And it's often been almost a cliche talk about this as cannabis makes people calm and alcohol can lead to domestic violence. And why, I talked to the police about this when they prefer a cannabis call to an alcohol call anytime. Mm-hmm. Is it just a nicer crowd?
Right. Just to go back, I'm mindful of our time and how long you've been with me, considering, you know, it's like almost a double interview. Do you need a break? Would you like to maybe pick up another day, or how are you feeling right now?
I wondered whether I would light my joint up or what.
Yeah, go for it. Absolutely.
I mean, I have the milk here too, so I got lots of power to go.
All right. Well,
I want to go for a little longer. I mean, it's unfortunate that I felt that first part was going really well.
Yeah.
Because I've done this so many times. It's always a little bit different. So I can always tweak it. But yeah. I felt pretty coherent.
You're very coherent. And you know what? I may make people suffer and listen to the garbled version of it, and who knows, maybe that will just be part of the voice distortion box you have on the on the beginning of our second. Who knows? I don't know. Whatever. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, I think all of this is really just getting a chance to hang with you and to hear your thoughts. I'm particularly interested in your experience of, and maybe this is how we can conclude this last chapter. Let's just say this is our last chapter. I'm particularly interested in your experience of the Canadian judicial system as it relates to your case and your reflections on it. So beginning with, you had a very beautiful description of the preparation you had for the arrest itself in 2009. And then moving through, I want to hear from your memory of what preparing for trial was like for you, and then sequentially going through to the appeal court and then the Supreme Court. And maybe, I don't know, as you recall some of the things that happened along the way, I'll prompt you, I'll give you some prods, but I also am interested in your relationship with your lawyer or lawyers, Kirk, and how you would work with him or how he'd work with you. I mean, I think that Kirk is a force, obviously, in Canada, in the cannabis world. And so, you know, and his mentor, John Conroy. So like, I think maybe that is a giant way of setting this stage for you to say whatever you want, you know, and however you want to say it. You can use voice modulation if you want to, but I just want you to kind of dive into that pool, if you will, of the, because the event, everybody knows, like, R.V. Smith, 2015, no more dried weed. We can, you know, we can have, okay, we all know that, but I want to know, like, what was your whole thing? How did it go for you? You know what I'm saying?
Well, I kind of pick it up again, because I had mentioned that my friend who was the soccer goalie, this is an experience with the police, was that I guess they'd seized things from my apartment and they'd taken to the evidence locker to store there, and we'd made oil in peanut butter jars, and we included an ingredient that helps to body to absorb cannabinoids. It's called lecithin. Lecithin is in lots of things, but it helps the myelin sheath in the brain, and that's where connective the tissue between. This is what where cannabinoids work in that area. So we included the lecithin in the product, and it's so sticky that, and of course the oil on the outside. They dropped one of these jars and it broke in the evidence locker, and they had to take pictures of it. So I have pictures of this oil splatter everywhere with this lecithin in it. I can tell you is impossible to clean. It's hard to get off. And so the whole police station filled with the smell of cannabis, the spirit of cannabis overtook the police station after I'd left. And you know, that I had this thing with the ID. They didn't have the right ID for me. So that's why my friend, he ID'd me. He was the police officer then. He was the one who dropped the thing. But because they didn't have a positive ID, when they send the paperwork with the charges, they had recommended that I see jail time for 4 months for this. What they suggested, and they attached my criminal record. What they said was my criminal record, but actually it wasn't mine. It was somebody else's, someone with a different middle name. It was Owen Blank Smith, not right. Owen Edward Smith, which is me. And my lawyer at that time, he was sort of like, why didn't you tell me about this stuff? You know, it would be a lot easier if you didn't do breaking and entering and assault with a deadly weapon and all this sort of stuff. I'm like, what are you talking about?
It's not me. That wasn't me. Send different, it. Different Owen Smith.
They don't know. They actually don't know what they're talking about. So I was, we did send it back, and I was sort of waiting for them to send me a new sentencing report. I wanted to know what sort of punishment they were. They didn't. And then we got to court, and the police officer is the first witness in court, and he's
your buddy, the soccer bully?
No, they kicked him off because he knew anybody who knew us got the boot.
Right.
But they had this evidence officer who he had gone through with a camera and he'd recorded the apartment, and so he had knowledge of the space, how it all looked and everything. So he was the first person to be interviewed. And so as part of their assessment, they value the products that they see. And so they had looked at what I'd made and they're like, oh, it's cannabis, it's oil. It must be, you know, hash oil. And hash oil, we know people are selling this 1 gram, $20 or something on the street. And so we can evaluate, we can put this to something like $800,000, I think they said, was the value of my oils.
Right.
But they were vegetable oils. So leaf-infused vegetable oils. Many of them were very low dose, very low strength. And Kirk Tusaw, who came in late to be my lawyer, who is a specialized in cannabis cases and specifically constitutional arguments, which is perfect for us. He pointed out to that, hey, look in the picture there. Don't you see the separation? See, it's emulsifying. You know, that's what happens with vegetable oils. It doesn't happen with the I guess we don't know what we're talking about. And so he had to leave, basically contributing nothing other than this videotape that they didn't end up even watching. So initially there, you've got fumbling, you know, slippery, smash, you've got paperwork sent to the wrong person. You've got people who don't know what they're looking at. It is a bit of a mess. And of course, the whole argument is me saying, like, I get out to the media. It's like, why you force people to smoke? Like, they just didn't, they had nothing to, they had nothing on the level. They couldn't meet us on the most basic argument. Why do you force children who have epilepsy smoke giant joints? Like, seriously. And it had to go all the way up to the Supreme Court of Canada and then make its way onto Power and Politics, where Mandy McKnight talked about her son directly to a conservative MP who stood there looking like he didn't know what the fuck he was talking about. It was shocking. I could see the guy turn white when they drilled him again. Well, your talking point means nothing. Why do you make these children smoke? Why won't you let these children have the thing that stops them from seizing and dying before they're a teenager? Like, who are you, cold, heartless beast? So it's sort of one of the issues which, it should never have been in place. It should never be. We know the arguments for prohibition are awful, and we've hit them lots down. And really, it's a terrible political football to hold on to when you get to the truth of the matter. And there's lots of governments around the world that still hold on to this cannabis is bad political football and will play it when they get to elections. And I'm hoping other governments have the gusto to think differently, like our government, current government, which has been in for God knows how long now, did, and to make cannabis legal.
Nebraska? You heard about Nebraska?
Is that a new one?
Nebraska is one of the four states in the U.S. that refuses to legalize for any purposes, let alone medicinal. And there is a legendary, it's turning into a legendary matchup between a former football star and Grant Wistrom and his coach, his former coach. So Grant apparently has his own dispensary now in another state, and he is a proponent of using at least CBD, but all you know, full spectrum cannabis for medicinal purposes, especially because of the football industry and what it's done to his body. But his coach is of that mindset that you're talking about, this holdout. And it's irredeemable, really, but it's what they believe in. And the governor, the former governor, Mr. Ricketts, last year was quoted as saying that if we legalize cannabis, it will kill your kids. And I'm just wondering, what's your reaction to that?
It's that political football, isn't it? If you can get anyone, if you can get someone to believe that you can believe anything, isn't that kind of the case with politics? Is that, you know, if you can get someone to believe something, they'll believe anything. That's one of these ways about it. It's something to do with people not having a very good sense for discerning information themselves. And really, the internet has been good and bad for that. You know, we've had a bit of a bloom of like everybody share and try to make it better. And then you have all this disinformation where it's like, well, we're trying to make value out of this now. So we have to deplete certain things and make things muddy. And that's not helped everybody. Right. You know, initially cannabis and the internet were like married. It's like cannabis rose in its stature in society because everybody was sharing, like, it, you know, real life accounts, impactful account, and all around being able to talk about it more openly. I mean, it was only a few decades ago in Canada that, you know, books about cannabis were illegal.
Right. Yes.
Amazing. And now you get to write a book about it. I'm writing a book about cannabis.
Oh, what are you writing?
Basically, the story that I've been telling. So the story of my trial and basically sort of a life story.
Excellent. Well, when you get published, we're definitely having another sit down. That's fantastic. How far in are you?
I've written it.
Nice.
And well, for the most part, I've done lots of research on the trial aspect. I'm trying to be very detailed in the trial aspect. I went through the entire 800 page transcripts and brought out the quotes and laid out the arguments from the government and how they approach the issue and how we defeat those arguments throughout. So hopefully it can be a useful tool for people around the world who maybe have to make these arguments in their country in a, like, you know, actual science, bring the actual science as well. And it was a duel between Health Canada's chief science officer and the scientist who we brought, who's been working on cannabis for many, many decades. And
who's that?
Dr. David Pate. Our scientist won the day quite clearly. And in that also brought lots of really interesting information about cannabis, which I'd never heard before. And I think people will like reading about.
Oh, nice. What are your plans for publishing it?
At this point, I do a lot myself. So I've got Affinity Publisher and I have the first section of the book all laid out.
Nice.
And I'm doing my own illustrations.
Nice.
I'm using AI to do that, like image generators.
Beautiful. If there's anything like that, your work on that I see on LinkedIn, you're posting all the time, it's going to be absolutely beautiful. I want a signed copy, Mr. Smith.
You get it.
It's been an absolute pleasure. I have 10,000 more questions for you, but I think I'm going to let you go because I can see we've been talking now for almost 2 hours, and I want to leave with one last thing before we go, and that is, my wife asked me to ask you this: is there? And this, I'm sorry, this I just had to ask you before we go. But is there a way to bake cookies without having the smell or the taste of cannabis that you get from the cookie, usually like a pod cookie.
You could make your oil separately, and if you have a distillate product or isolate product, it has all of the scent removed. So an easy way is a isolate powder. When you have the isolate powder, like the CBD powder, you really just take a digital scale and you measure, you can see the milligrams because it's 99 point something percent. So then you can very accurately dose your cookies with a powder, isolate powder.
Nice.
Mm-hmm. I don't see isolate THC isolate powder very often though.
No.
Or in the CBD realm.
Hmm. Right.
Yeah.
There's so many more things I want to find out from you. Will you have a second kick at the can at this with me?
You bet. Thanks so much, Russell.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Cannabis Law in Canada. As you may guess, this interview is not legal advice. And if you need legal advice, please contact a lawyer. We're always working on making this the best podcast for our listeners. So if you have suggestions for an interview or ideas for episodes, please contact us at cannabislaw.ca.